You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
We've been looking at talent development, and we're now going to look at an issue that's very challenging and pressing, particularly for this reason, region, the idea around talent attraction and talent retention. Some really big strategic challenges there. So I'm delighted that we're going to have on stage with us Stephen Duggan. He is the Director of Education Partnerships at the Microsoft Corporation. He's worked in education for more than 30 years. His interests focus on how technology can transform student outcomes and the needs of underserved learners and communities. He wrote and presented the award-winning documentary, The First Mile, and his views on education have featured across the media across the world. He's a member of the governing board of the UNESCO Institute for Information Technologies and Education, and he works with Matuto Literacy for Life Partnership and the Collaborative Assessment Alliance. We also will be joined by Anamika Srivastava. She's the assistant professor and fellow at O.P. Jindal Global University in India. Anamika is the assistant director of the Center for International Trade and Economic Laws at O.P. Jindal. Her research focuses on an economic approach to education policy, and topics she has published on include quasi-markets in education, education for sustainable development, and interdisciplinarity in educational studies. She's currently working on the state higher education plan for Haryana under a government scheme to provide strategic funding to eligible state higher education institutions. And finally, we have Irat Kaznyakov. He's the director of the Higher School of Information Technologies and Intelligent Systems at Kazan Federal University. And I believe the furniture is now in place and our colleagues have their microphones on. Really, this session is about talent. So I'd like to really get the panel, because we're podcasting this, I'd like to get the panel to tell us a little bit about themselves. But just to set the scene, I think there is an issue here that we talk in terms of talent. In this region in particular, we think hard about brain drain. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a serious exodus of talent from Russia, and only now we're starting to see policies that are addressing that. In India, of course, where Anamika is from, we have an issue of capacity. We were talking earlier, actually, that some of the outstandingly talented young people in India have been lured to jobs and careers outside India, particularly in the West and North America. Of course, we have a brilliant Indian running one of the world's greatest technology companies, Microsoft, and some other tech companies that we may be familiar with. But there is a sense that technology is changing the landscape. It's changing our requirements around the mobility of people and the geography of talent, and it allows us to transcend some of these challenges. But before we get into the policy issue, I'd love to just get to know the panel a little bit more. And I wondered, perhaps we could start with you, Anamika. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey? You're obviously one of a very talented panel. Tell us how you got to where you are, and as a young scholar in India, what your journey has been to reach this position now.
Thank you, Phil. First of all, I would like to thank THE and Kazan Federal University for inviting me to this first ever summit on Eurasia. And I think it's interesting to talk about myself, because I have been a student of a public institution in India throughout my life. And I happened to work with a very reputed college in India, which was called Lady Sri Ram College. And through those networks, I got to know about O.P. Jindal Global, quote-unquote, university. It was a relatively new university at the point of time when I joined it in 2012. And I had my set of inhibitions, since a private university is seen with a lot of negative connotation in my country because of, you know, valid reasons. There are other private institutions which are highly commercial and have been set up as teaching shops. So I had my set of inhibitions, but as I see the growth of the institution, you know, my vice chancellor has several stories about the transformation of the institution. I can at least tell me using my own example that people are also transforming in the process. And see, today I'm sitting here with you sharing the stage. So it's like, it's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Irad, could we just get to know a little bit about you personally as well before we kick into the policy discussion?
Yeah, I'm. How I occurred in the of information technology and intelligence systems here at KFU is I went to have my PhD in Germany. It was 2002. When I did my PhD and then I thought about my career, I realized that whenever I went during my PhD time, when my studies, I met a lot of Russians. Like if you go to Max Planck Institute for Mathematics in Bonn, it which that you would hear the most. So I thought, are there any Russians left in Russia? I should go. But seriously speaking, the most attractive point for me to go back to Russia and to work here was the challenges, because the higher education in Germany was by far more established by then. As you mentioned, due to the tremendous brain drain after the collapse of the USSR, of the Soviet Union. So the challenges that actually I was meeting here, the offer I was getting here was by far more difficult, hard, and that was attractive for me.
Thank you very much. And Stephen, you have an illustrious CV and a wonderful range of expertise. But how did you get to be in your position at a very senior role at Microsoft?
But gosh, Phil, I ask myself that question every day. I'm actually a teacher by profession. I spent 12 years before joining Microsoft teaching literature to 12 to 18-year-olds, including the stories of my very favorite writer, Anton Chekhov, and ended up in Microsoft through a series of accidents. I actually attended a graduate recruitment fair with the resume from my brother, who was looking for a new job, and somehow ended up with one myself. It took 2 years before he talked to me about that again. But I suppose the key factor is probably of importance to me in terms of education is as a parent. I'm a parent of 6 kids. My eldest is 23, my youngest is 8, which means that I'll have more than 2 decades of continuous engagement with higher education by the time my youngest child graduates. So I have a particular interest in this area.
There's a wonderful element there of serendipity. I think there is a role for serendipity in people's career paths and obviously the opportunities that arise. But with 6 kids, I'm surprised you have time for anything else. That's amazing. Let's get into the policy environment. Annamika, I mentioned India, that again, it's a country that's associated with developing great talent, but losing a lot of great talent. What's the policy environment in India at the moment in terms of how it can build a strong higher education system in terms of retaining academic talent?
So, in the Indian context, of course, the government has now become very conscious about the fact that they need to build world-class institutions, and the process is on. They are in the process of selecting 10 public and 10 private institutions, 6 of them already being selected. And they're talking about internationalization, but I would say that they have come to this this entire objective quite late, and there is an issue here with respect to the number of students who are going abroad. India is losing almost, you know, from 60,000 students in 2000 to 0.25 million students in 2016. Now, this is a huge exodus of the students, and this is despite of the visa issues, problems of the intercultural communication, and matters concerning rights of xenophobia in general. Not to say that these issues are not important, but this has become a very important, you know, brain drain issue in the Indian context. Of course, Indians are spending a lot of money. In terms of money, around $3.7 billion is being sent abroad as maintenance of close relatives, usually meant for maintaining the students abroad and studies abroad, with these two terms accounting almost 45% of outward remittances. So it's a huge, huge loss in the country. And think about a country which has a huge trade deficit. And this extent of remittance is something that the government is conscious about and have started thinking about it. But I would say in terms of policy context, the macro context, the Indian government is quite late to catch up with this, and we're really looking forward to, and in fact relying on institutional efforts and intrinsic motivation of individual leaders. So I think that is something that we're looking forward to in terms of policy space.
So there's a sense in India that there's been a huge increase in higher education capacity. Maybe quality hasn't corresponded with that in terms of it's been a vast expansion of the system and it's stretched institutions. So that one of the solutions that, you know, the government's come up with is the Excellence Initiative, the Institutions of Eminence. But is there anything equivalent to perhaps one of the most successful examples of this, which is in China, which was a very concerted effort to get the Chinese diaspora to return? They pursued their undergraduate studies in the United States or in Western Europe. They stayed there, they built careers, but China's been remarkably successful at luring them back, and it costs money, it takes a lot of effort, but is there something like that in India, or are they still a little bit late to that policy and environment?
Phil, I can talk about my own institution. So this my university, OP General Global University, when I joined it in 2012, I remember that, you know, as I said, it's global. There were a lot of international faculty. I remember I was sharing my office with an American citizen who was Sri Lankan from origin, and he was a Harvard graduate. So I had this curiosity that, okay, why did you join Jindal? You had so many other options. And I remember he talked about financial incentives, which, you know, in that way, Jindal is quite fortunate to have had an initial corpus of huge amount of money, which was been given by a philanthropist to the university. And of course, a lot of autonomy with it. But, you know, he also talked about the kind of opportunity that this institution gave in terms of, you know, teaching what you like, make your own course manual, organize seminar, attend seminar. I mean, in that sense, zero bureaucracy. And when there was such, and the institutions was actually trusting the people. And trust played a very important role, because with trust came a sense of responsibility. And this responsibility was not just towards the institution, that we need to be accountable to the institution. This responsibility was towards ourselves. You know, once you're given with so much resources and time, and, you know, you're being trusted, we started thinking that we need to go beyond, you know, let's say our own private interest, and start thinking about excellence. And I think that created a very important role in creating that critical mass that was absolutely needed.
And it seems to me maybe that it's about individual initiatives. So your university, OP Jindal Global University, is, as you say, private, not for profit. It comes from perhaps an inspirational benefactor, but also a very strong leader. Is it a sense in India that it's about individual institutions, organizations taking the initiative? There's no real national policy agenda here. It is about strong leaders in India making that decision and setting up systems that allow people to come through, but the national system perhaps isn't quite as geared up for this. As I've talked about,
as you've also mentioned, that there's the Institutions of Eminence initiative that has come into the picture there, where government has actually started talking about creating world-class institutions and providing them with the kind of money that is needed, although not to the private institutions. Yes, India has largely relied on the intrinsic motivation of the people, and how, you know, there are people who have been, for instance, we're talking about artificial intelligence in Industry 4.0, and there are people who were living abroad in the United States. They're coming back to the country to give back to the society where they belong, where they live their childhood, and they're actually facing, so, you know, a lot of hurdles to form collaboration between, let's say, a public university and the government. But however, the government is now opening up, and there's a possibility of such collaborations in the future, and we are hopeful that, you know, things would change in the future.
Thank you very much. And Ira, you studied in Germany, and then you returned here to Kazan. We've heard a little bit about your own story, but what is the policy context here? Is Russia making itself attractive enough for Russian nationals to come back and build their careers, build their academic careers here? What's the policy context for Russia?
There is the Pulse, there is the 5100 program, which is making efforts to focus the resources to gather the new professions from abroad and the expatriates back to Russian universities. And within that program, we had training, the young leaders of the university actually got training from the best education experts from all over the world. We went to Skolkovo, spent there some time, several times a year, and that actually was tremendous. But I actually want to entertain you a little bit, if you allow me, with one story by Ernesto Siroli. He worked for NGO in Africa. They went there to help their economical development. And what Italians normally do very well is the agriculture, and actually they told them farming. So they went to Zambezi River Valley, and they thought that these wonderful fertile lands are not that there is no agriculture. And they brought the best seeds from Italy of the tomatoes and zucchinis, and actually showed how to plant them to the locals, and they planted. And actually, if the tomatoes grew this size in Italy, they grew this size in Africa. That was wonderful, and they were very proud how they actually saved a particular part of the world in Zambia. And when the tomatoes were finally ripe, around 200 hippos came out of Zambezi River and ate the harvest. And that's it. So the reason is that although we actually got the training from all the leaders of the education from all over the world, the recipes, they just don't work locally, unfortunately. On the other hand, we managed to attract resources to equip our labs, to attract the researchers to join our university. But actually, we don't really have the clear view how actually get to the top 100 within the 2 years, for example.
So as a young academic, what are you looking for when you make your decisions about your choice? Obviously, you want a good infrastructure, a good reputation, reasonable terms and conditions. What is it that would make the difference between you choosing one university in one country over another?
When I went to the business breakfast with Nick, and he talked about the recruitment and statistics of Times Higher Education, he actually shared that the most important, probably he's somewhere here, there was a great presentation, that the probably the most important factor was the culture of the organization the young researcher would join with. But I also would say that I think the culture and the challenges. So if you have a great challenge within a particular institution, for example, have two opportunities to join an organization with good culture and established teams and play a role of a junior researcher with your background, with your CV, the offer. And on the other hand, you have probably an institution that doesn't fare as well in terms of ratings and reputation, but on the other hand, you have the opportunity to have your own team and perform as a senior researcher and pursue your own objectives, and probably you might choose the other option. And actually, I asked Nick about the cliques, if the graduates of the top universities stay within the same cliques, and he said yes, that they do so. And I think is one of the most important challenges for Russian universities. As probably you know, that the Russian universities before the 5100 program, they were all domestic universities. They did educate internationally. Their main objective was to educate local students. And that means that if you educate locally, you actually can't hire globally. You don't expect that Harvard graduate would definitely speak Russian, although many of them do, but I mean, just because they came from Russia and they are Russians, but there are not so many of them. So now it's changing just because of the drive of the program, and it's getting easier. We have English medium programs, and we hire internationally, and international academics can join Russian universities, and that leads to that Russian universities are getting better recognized internationally just because you know about that it exists. Before that, academics internationally even wouldn't know about the existence of such universities in Russia.
Thank you. And Nick, keep alert, because I think maybe when the mics come out, we'll ask you a little bit more about the research that you've done on what actually motivates people in making their career choices. And it'd be great to hear from more of the audience about that as well. But Stephen, I'd like to go back to you. We're talking about the physical environment, the terms and conditions, we're talking about visas and diaspora. Will this all matter in a few years' time? Will technology render the sort of physical need to have people in the country or in a particular institution, will that render that whole situation with visas and immigration and populism, will that become a moot point? Will we be just using technology to connect and communicate so we don't need to worry about physical place? What's your perspective there?
It's an interesting question. I suppose the first thing you can say is that the internet doesn't require a visa. You know, so certainly in terms of mobility of knowledge, there aren't those constraints. You know, I think if you think about what technology does as its best, it connects, it empowers, and it accelerates. And, you know, I think of a classic example. Michael Fullan once said that if teachers can be replaced by technology, they should be. But the reality is, if you take an example like the Khan Academy, Khan Academy in 2014 were reaching 260 million students worldwide. What people may not be aware is that they were doing that with 32 teachers. As an illustration of how technology can actually scaffold an extension of influence for great educators, for great talent. The other open question is whether this has an impact upon mobility. Now, the reality is that education has become so collaborative. We're not often talking about individual achievement anyway. We're talking about the ability to collaborate effectively across teaching, learning, and research. And there's no doubt that technology is having a significant impact upon that.
Yeah. Maybe it's worth going straight to Anamika on that. There's a sense that India has perhaps the most acute challenges with talent, but also has some of the finest minds in terms of technology. The IITs in India, of course, are renowned for producing outstanding technologists. Do you feel the solutions to these big, big problems in India will be technological? Distance learning, new forms of collaboration between scholars across borders. What have you seen on the ground in India that could potentially have a major effect here?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because whenever we think about future technology or artificial intelligence, Industry 4.0, we talk about India in a disadvantageous position that, you know, okay, the talent will actually move to clusters of excellence and not to countries like India. And how will India then rethink about the strategies of internationalization, etc.? But the way I would look at artificial intelligence is to co-opt the entire process of all these future technologies into the very act of doing research. The theme that we're talking about is how to attract the next generation of research stars. I think we need to redefine the way we are talking about research stars. And the stardom will be redefined in a way that will actually co-opt people who are working on the ground. They are actually getting the deep insight from indigenous communities of India. They are doing social innovation work. They are actually focusing on, you know, larger societal concern. Now, the problem is that the current matrix that actually captures research excellence is a very, you know, straight-jacketing way of looking at what research excellence would look like. I think in the future, with artificial intelligence, a lot of issues of identifying the problem, or say literature review, or the cosmetic elements of an article or journal-ready article would be taken care by the artificial intelligence or an algorithm. Now, that will actually place India in a very good situation, because Indian academic, as I look at them, they have deep insight about their own society. They have a lot of information. They have data. They have knowledge. But they are not able to cut a mark in a global landscape because of issues such as, you know, language, you know, problem and method issue. And I think once artificial intelligence comes into the picture, these issues will be taken care of by the machines, and people, right, from researchers to the reviewers, then can focus on the most important aspect of research, which is the value addition aspect. And that will actually make a lot of sense in a country like India, where Indian researchers will we will start contributing in a meaningful manner, with and they will do away with the hurdles, the so-called language hurdles or methodology hurdles, and also contribute back to the society, Indian society, which actually needs such interventions.
It's fascinating. I think the capacity for AI to reduce labor and free up creative time is interesting. But we heard yesterday from Sir Malcolm Grant about the role of AI in actually carrying out research algorithmically, particularly in areas like drug discovery. Mm. Is there a sense even that the superstar academic will be less of a thing in the future, because there'll be way more collaborative work, way more AI algorithmic exercises that reach new discoveries through a different process? Is that something that maybe will be true, or we'll always need the individual genius and the eureka moment? Stephen, maybe you could reflect a bit on the types of uses that are being made of technology in research. Are there any examples from Microsoft's perspective in terms of how universities are harnessing research to improve the output?
One example I would give, because it has such an importance from a social point of view and environmental, is we know that there's increasingly a challenge with plastic pollution in our oceans. Mm-hmm. And we've been collaborating with the Technical University of Delft on a solution using AI and data and analytics to see how we can address that. And that is very much a collaborative process, not only between TU of Delft, but between multiple universities across the globe. The intention there, you know, there's 10 terabytes of data on weather patterns alone, which we're helping to support and interrogate. And the hope of that project is that they can reduce plastic pollution in the oceans by 50% within 5 years. So it's an illustration of how ambitious you can be when you can harness the power of research and, you know, supplement that with the power of technology.
Yeah, it's an incredible notion that we talk about robots replacing so many of our jobs, but actually robots could make a huge contribution to new discoveries and to really push forward the bounds of human knowledge, really, just by harvesting this mass data, machine learning to actually push experimental issues further and further. Irat, you're the director of the Higher School of Information Technologies and Intelligent Information Systems. What's your perspective on how we can harness technology to change academic life?
We mostly work with intelligent systems, and we actually do our best to harness technology in various fields of application. As for researchers' life, I think the advent of artificial intelligence and computational intelligence in general, first of all, will decrease the amount of routine work that researchers have to do. The applications that Annamika has mentioned, and also grants applications, evaluation of the teaching materials, because I believe that research that doesn't teach probably doesn't want to extend his own research team. So I believe that there will be still place for human work. I really strongly believe in that in the university, and that change actually that differentiates universities from projects like Coursera, although people work there and definitely real human, of course, do that. But the personal connection within the university plays, I believe, the most important role for in this differentiation. And the research teams, they grow not only because of the challenging tasks, interesting work, but also because of the teacher and the professor, the researcher, the primary researcher that actually attracts the new students to his group. That's one thing where the humans still stay. As for the aspects where the technology will relieve us from routine and help us is, I think that the aspects of the human work that machines will never be able to perform as well as humans do is the humanity. So I believe that in terms of application of the computational technology, just like in the case with Khan Academy, where 30 teachers can actually teach 167 million students, the applications, the development in intelligence system or computing science will be able to contribute to many different fields within actually across the universities, and that will make the possible discoveries by the economists, psychologists, and many other fields easier in the end of the day. I also think that we are now at a position where the star researchers, they won't fade away, and I actually think that there will be the vacancy of star researchers, but just like the stars in the sky, there might be a lot of them, and the technology will allow us to choose the right star for particular collaboration, for particular project. If you're a star in a particular field today still you might stay unfound for a significant period of time, and with the acceleration of economy, even 1 year matters. The window of opportunity passes by very fast. With the advent of artificial intelligence, that will happen less frequent. That's what I believe in. So when you are a star in a particular field, you'll be found faster and find your application, find the transfer of the technology from the academia to the industry. And I think the industry-academic collaboration will accelerate. That's what I think.
And can I just go back to the idea of around human talent? When you were establishing the Higher School of Information Technologies, which is a relatively new organization, how do you attract individuals when you're competing with maybe Silicon Valley schools and you know, MIT and Stanford? How do you get the talent, and what was your strategy to bring people to come and work with you at the school?
Thank you for this question. It's really my favorite task. I didn't find a silver bullet for that. I can share several stories, and you could probably infer how different it is for different people. For example, we have a primary researcher, Max Talanov, who works in memristive technology, neuromorphic computing, and effective computing, which is a very hot topic. He's experimenting now with memristive prosthetics for the spinal cord, and we're experimenting in the Mayo Clinic in the USA with this. And he joined us from the industry. We found him in a huge industrial company working as an architect. He had his PhD in computing, but he was aspiring to he was doing research on his own as a hobby. And we discovered him in this company, and we said to him that he has this opportunity in the academia, and he should try to do that even for less money than he gets in the industry. And that's how we found Max. Then another story is, we had a researcher, Vlada Gugurakova, who worked in a different department doing different things, and he aspired for AR, VR, but she didn't have the team to do that. So we found a startup, and we actually persuaded the startup to share the team that she had with the leader that we had. And the team joined the university, and Vlada joined the team, and we got the team in AR, VR. That's second story. The third story that I have is Salvatore Di Stefano. He was a professor at Politecnica di Milano by then, and we communicated with the government of Republic of Tatarstan to issue a fellowship for such a researcher to attract a good researcher to the Kazan Federal University. And the point was that why we actually were looking for researchers elsewhere and looking for new topics was that we already had a computing mathematics institute in the university. So our challenge was to create something that hasn't been here before, something new, and therefore we looked for people elsewhere and people that didn't work in the university primarily. And then we got this fellowship, we made an open competition, and Salvatore won it and joined our university. And the fourth story I wanted to share is a story of Evgeny Magid, who had a great experience working with Carnegie Mellon, Tsukuba University, Bristol University, and he joined us thanks to 5100 program, because we could provide the equipment, the opportunities, and the team that he always wanted to have to pursue his topics. All these four stories are very different. So there isn't a universal way to attract talent to the higher school for information technology and intelligent systems. And that's something is very challenging for me, because that means that replacement is a very challenging task, and the growth is also more art than actually a process.
Yeah, it's great to have the personal stories, because it really is an individual choice about how you persuade someone to make that leap and to join you and building a culture that makes them feel they want to be part of it. Perhaps that takes us on nicely back to Stephen, perhaps from an employer perspective in terms of graduate talent, as one of the great tech companies of the world, a highly desirable place to work. What sort of skill sets do you look for in the young people or in the early career people that you would seek to hire and join you at Microsoft? What's your sort of recruitment picture?
So first of all, I'd say it's a massive challenge for us. There are literally thousands of open jobs in Microsoft right now because we can't find people with the talent and skills. But we are seeing innovation in that area. I'd give the example of MGIMO University here in Russia, which has introduced a new course focused on digital economy and artificial intelligence, where they're working in collaboration with Microsoft and ADV Advertising to create courses which give the capabilities and that combination, for example, of business skills and digital and technology skills that are at most demand out there in the industry. I mean, the reality is that the student cohort right now that we're looking at is entirely different, and the universities and colleges are looking at is entirely different. They're social, they're global, they're connected, and they're very, very demanding. You know, I think of another example from here in Russia, the Russian Financial University, which is now providing 24/7 access on any device to their courses, virtual laboratories, etc. But you know, if I think about our challenge in terms of attracting and retaining talent, that may be a little illustrative. You know, so how does Microsoft attract people in this circumstance? And I suppose there's a number of things that help us attract it. First of all is the environment itself. You know, people coming to Microsoft expect to be in a productive environment, which is a place where they can thrive and they progress. I don't think that's any different from a higher education institution. The second thing that we look at as being important is culture. So I think that's also true. We talked earlier about the possibility that, you know, physical colleges could be made redundant. I don't think that's true. You know, there is still something about the cultural experience which is very attractive about being on a campus and benefiting in all the different ways that you can do from that. For us, that culture also means diversity as well, and a culture of innovation. You know, thirdly, what we look for is access to innovation itself and to technology. And access to technology is actually a prerequisite, a requirement for young people today. They won't go backwards in time. They expect the working environment and the study environment to be something that reflects their needs and speaks to their values and their experiences. And lastly, there's that issue of flexibility. You know, we don't have a 40-hour week in Microsoft. People are free to work whatever hours work for them. And we see that in education as well. You know, it might surprise you, for example, to know that in the US, 50% of people studying in colleges have either a full-time or a part-time job. In fact, a significant percentage of students in American colleges are single parents. And if you think about the challenges they have, they demand the opportunity to have anytime, anyplace learning, but also to learn at their own pace, to look at different types of qualifications, to look at different ways in which they can interact with that environment, be it physical or virtual.
Yeah, and I think that there's a really important element there of just culture, isn't there? I think in higher education, there's a challenge around red tape and bureaucratization and metricization, and some of the most successful universities, I think, are those that create freedom as much as you can within the constraints of modern expectations around being accountable for your salary, for public money in the case of universities. But trying to give people that flexibility and freedom is really important. I'd quite like to open it up. If we have some microphones around, do we have microphones? Any support on the, oh, here we go. Would you mind taking the mic up to Nick in the corner? Irat mentioned Nick's work on what people look for in making decisions. I think it might be a nice way of starting a conversation, and I'd like to ask more people in the audience what attracts them in terms of making their career choices. Nick, do you mind?
Yeah, of course. Hello. Thank you, Phil. I think Irat was absolutely right. It's not just about organizational culture, understanding that you're moving to an organization where you're going to fit. It's inherent really within academics that they want to be challenged, so they need to know that this is an institution where they're going to find those challenges and then the culture around it that's going to support them to overcome those challenges. I think there was an interesting point, and there's a resonance between AI freeing up creative time And I think there's a resonance with the way in which the digital age of recruitment is freeing up human resources specialists and recruitment specialists' time to think smarter about who they're looking to recruit and how they're going to go about doing it, and moving from the very functional process that I think many universities believed that the recruitment was to a far more strategic one. So I think, as I said, I think there's a resonance there. One final point just on the idea of universities over industry, which I think was very interesting. And I had a conversation with Tanya Stanker, I'm not sure she's here with us at the moment, yesterday morning from the Kazan Aviation Institute. And her theory around this of why people would choose universities over industry is the multidisciplinary nature of universities and being surrounded by people from various backgrounds, from various different fields, where true innovation, she feels, really comes from. And that is the defining factor of why a university would be a better place for a really ambitious young academic.
It's interesting, I think, corporations tend to be able to pay higher salaries, and there's a fear that talented young academics will be lured into the private sector where terms and conditions are often better. But the flip side is the freedom and culture. But I think more and more, certainly tech companies are trying to create that creative environment themselves. Is there a sense that companies like Microsoft, perhaps, Stephen, could start recreating in their own R&D teams sort of academic-style cultures and offer the level of freedom and autonomy to people? Is that part of your offer now as well as a corporation?
It's no accident that most of the technology companies talk about their campus. You know, Microsoft talks about the Microsoft campus, which is 164 buildings spread over a huge area with its own transport system. But the reality is that research is actually at the center of everything we do. Microsoft spends $9 billion a year on research and has a significant voice in the research community. You know, Microsoft Research itself, as an organization, is bringing together and harnessing the power of academics around the world to look at some of the largest challenges that exist, you know, both socially and technologically. You know, so I think to a degree those cultures aren't either mutually exclusive or that different. You know, you talk about paying conditions, and yes, there's probably a difference there. But in terms of the things that attract people to corporations like Microsoft, I don't think there's a difference in terms of that, you know, that desire for the ability to work in an interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary environment and to innovate.
One of the questions is, are there now such giant and such innovative technology companies that sometimes they can maybe act without the higher education system? They build their own R&D cultures, their own internal research structures, and their own talent management. Is there a sense that Microsoft still feels very strongly that you need to work with universities? You can't do it alone. There's different qualities brought by the different sectors.
Absolutely. For us, it's about collaboration. You know, we collaborate on every one of our research projects with the world of academia. And, you know, we don't do that as leaders in many cases, but as enablers. You know, I worked for a long period of time with UNESCO on the issue of literacy as a foundational education challenge. And we began that conversation not by saying this is what you need to do, but by asking what do you need us to do? How can technology actually enable what you see as the issues that are most needed in addressing? You know, and that's proved to be a fascinating journey for us, which has led to a lot of innovation in that area. But again, we haven't been the leaders, we've been the people trying to answer the questions.
It's interesting, Times Higher Education did a piece of research for last year's World Economic Forum at Davos. We worked with the Gulf Group, the Global University Leaders Forum, so it's about 25, 26 of the world's elite universities, Berkeley and Oxford and Cambridge and a whole range of others. And actually we examined industry research partnerships, co-authored papers, and Microsoft was the single largest corporate partner of this supergroup of top research universities. So it's testament to the fact that you have a highly collaborative approach to the work at Microsoft. We do have time. I would like to open it up to a conversation, so please do raise your hand. I may adopt the university lecture approach and just come out into the audience with a microphone and force you all to speak. It's the last session. I want to see some energy. But does anyone else want to share their own stories about what will motivate them in terms of making a choice of destination. We have a thank you very much for raising your hand. If we can get the microphone, please introduce yourself. I should have said, I assumed everybody knows Nick. Nick Davis is one of our directors who looks after our hiring solutions business, just in case anyone didn't know.
First of all, I have a question. Can I ask my question in Russian to speakers? No? Is it possible?
For those of us who don't speak Russian, there's one...
I was just wondering, maybe you have an earphone translator?
I can try to translate.
Please
okay,
do.
No problem. I have a question to Professor Srivastava. You as a young researcher who is working in university in your native country, and you have a problem of that young people go abroad to study and stay there forever. Just imagine if you would be a prime minister of India, for example, what measure would you implement to attract those specialists who came abroad again back to India? Thank you.
I'm sure you will be the Prime Minister of India sometime, not too far in the future.
Thank you. I want to be the president, actually, because that's the nominal head of the country. You just need to get
job.
To live in a palace. So thank you for that question. Yes, I have an opinion on that. What China has done, I mean, that's you need to spend. You need to spend, you need to provide the right kind of incentives in terms of finances to bring the talent back. That's the most important factor. But apart from that, if I have the power and authority to set the rules for the for the faculty members, or let's say have a say in designing the governance structure of the institution, I would say let the university be governed by the academics. And there shouldn't be any political intervention. I mean, that's the first thing that I would like to do in my country to begin with. And as I've mentioned my own experience with my university at Jindal University, institutional autonomy and academic autonomy is something that we really value and we're really, really proud of. So I think that's the first thing that I would do. And it's actually absolutely necessary.
Thank you very much. That's a great answer. I'm looking for hands. If I don't get any, I will just start picking on members of the audience. Anyway, did you have a question, sir? We do have our Rutgers colleague at the front, if we can get the mic over. Just for the sake of the audio tape, if you could introduce yourself, even though we all know who you are.
When you know you've asked too many questions. Andrew Gow from Rutgers University. So we've talked a lot of today about artificial intelligence, remote learning, all these different aspects to it. One of the things that I would sort of comment and that maybe ask you to comment about how this goes, one of the things that attracts talent is actually being mentored, being helped, going to an environment where there are people to interact with in an actual organic way. You can only do so much remotely. And so is that one of the bigger challenges if you're trying to set up, where we can talk about older and established research units that have been around for a long time, so they have a culture and they have a people who are already there. If you're trying to do something newer into a newer university, and we talked about some of the newer universities in Eurasia earlier this morning, is there a way to do that, that we can sort of generate the culture that would move?
It's probably worth asking you, Amika. The task at Jindal was to convince people to join a university that didn't really exist. It's only, 6-7 years old now? How do you get a start to take a risk, to say come to something that doesn't exist yet and help us build it? I mean, is that the cell itself?
Talking about the founding years of Jindal University, I think the most important factor that I would raise from a faculty perspective was the leadership. There were founding members of the university. It was a very small team. Very few people were involved. But those who were involved, they invested in this entire enterprise grossly. They went beyond the call for duty, and they they had this idea that, see, they're setting up another private university in India. By the way, India has 800 universities, 300 of them are private. So they were conscious of the fact that they are not setting up another private university in this national higher education landscape, but addressing or locating or positioning themselves in the global landscape. And that led to the whole idea of hiring international faculty. And so your question is absolutely, your comment is absolutely important, because physical presence was important. I mean, unless I come here, I will not be able to know about the Russian culture, people, and faculty members, and I've now got to know about them. Similarly, I think the beginning was where people were, before the establishment of the physical space called Jindal University, they were organizing conferences. And there were like these joint meetings that were happening. And people were coming and listening to the deliberation. And that was convincing, which led to the idea that, okay, there's a possibility of such an idea.
Please go ahead, Stephen.
I'd like to be slightly disruptive here. I think, you know, it's seen as a truism that there's nothing better than face-to-face interaction. And, you know, there's a huge amount of truth in that, but it's not always possible. You know, and I think of an example. We partnered with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and with British Council, who are a not-for-profit organization, to try to bring education to refugees in Syria. Now, in many cases, you were talking about kids who one day were in school and the following day that school was gone because they had been transplanted. And the only way we could do that was to bring teachers virtually into effective classrooms, when those classrooms were just tents. And what we discovered, which really surprised us, was that in many cases, the educational outcomes were just as good. And in some cases, they were better. And in one respect, they were better because for the first time, as an example, learning English, they were learning from native speakers, people that actually spent some time in an English language environment. And one example just of AI in that area is that we've again been working with British Council on the AI assessment of spoken English. And this was down to, if you think of it to a degree, the issue of redundancy or automation, getting rid of jobs and making them redundant. There's a challenge in learning English. And learning English along with ICT skills has become foundational for employability. And one of the challenges we have right now is that we don't have enough people who can physically assess spoken English. It takes time and it takes those people itself. We've devised an AI solution with British Council which allows people to do that through an AI environment, through a simple web service. What that means is we're democratizing the learning itself, because now literally millions of more learners can learn those skills. You know, and as we try and build those things out, I should also mention that we have a new program which my colleagues in Russia have set up called Digital Ambassadors, which allows people, you know, Julia is here actually just in the audience. If anyone wants to learn more about that and ways in which you can collaborate with us as institutions, we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. And I think that's a really important point, actually, when we talk about the mobility of talent. There's almost a language tyranny in the sense that people talk about rankings, that there's an English language bias, but actually English is the lingua franca of global scholarly communication. So there is an inherent advantage to English-speaking countries in terms of mobility and jobs opportunities. So improvements in technology to empower more people with language skills is good. But I just wonder if we're now getting to the point with technology where language becomes less and less relevant because translation systems are getting so sophisticated. Can you know, the science fiction version of the Babel fish that instantly translates in your ear, is that becoming a reality yet, or is that something way off?
To a degree, it exists. You know, people may not be aware, but Skype right now offers simultaneous oral translation. So we've seen this in remarkable interactions between students at higher education in K-12 who do not speak each other's language, holding conversations. You know, in real time, this real-time translation, not just in terms of text to text, but speech to speech. So I think those innovations are developing. I don't think it makes anything redundant. I think what it does is, again, it removes the barriers for cooperation. Right now, we have a challenge within this room in that people have to be able to speak English to participate. If we can remove challenges like that, what we're doing is we're really opening up the dialogue that can exist.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a couple of minutes. I'm happy to squeeze in another one. Otherwise, I'm going to ask Irat to take the final question. Anyone else burning? Oh, we have one question in the middle. We have about 4 or 5 minutes, if we can make it as quick as possible. And please introduce yourself as well.
Yeah, well, hello. It's not actually a question. It's a story that you asked to share about a young researcher.
Perfect.
Yeah, my name is Elena, and I'm a young researcher here at the Institute of Psychology and Education, Kazan Federal University. And my story of a young researcher is like this. probably some of you know that in Russia we have this program. It's a governmental program that funds young intellectuals who wants to study abroad but who doesn't have some financials, probably funds. So at the Institute of Psychology and Education here, there are three young researchers who won the scholarship, studied in UK, came back here, and the task was, when you're given your master's degree, which we all have with distinctions, of course, and the task was to work here in Russia for 3 years, and then you're free to go anywhere you'd like. But I'd like to emphasize that here, coming back to Russia and starting research and having obviously the experience of doing research in the UK and then doing research in Russia, and that's kind of really different spheres in terms of resources, funds, and mentoring again. But the thing is, they presented us here at Kazan Federal University with such great opportunities that working only for 9 months today, I started only in October, no, not 11, my mathematics is bad, sorry. And we've been doing lots of research projects, and we've been invited to many international conferences and to other countries to do research there, only working for 1 year. So that's how Russia attracts us young researchers back, and that's how they provide all the resources here at Kazan Federal University, which I'm very grateful for. That's my story.
Thank you. I really appreciate you sharing that. It's almost the perfect note to end on, but we have 2 more minutes, so I did want to just go back to Ayrat. The focus of this event has been Eurasia and this particular region, and in the research and in the conversations we've had, there's been a sense that there is a genuine change in geopolitics. We know that Kazan has great wealth from oil and gas, but it's turning a lot of that economic strength into new knowledge and skills and IT. Also, the whole changing geopolitics with Belt and Road, of course, and this sort of merging of East and West, this geographical reality of the supercontinent. Irrespective of what we heard about digital and remote, is there a sense that actually this part of the world has to worry less and less about brain drain and can now become a genuine hub and a magnet for talent, because there's so much happening here that's diverse and vibrant and exciting for young scholars and workers?
I agree. It's exactly what we're experiencing here in Kazan. Probably one of the reasons is just the geographical position in the middle of Russia, and actually nearly the place, the Ural Mountains, where the East actually meets West, geographically the Asia with Europe. But Kazan is also a very tolerant city where the Muslims, the Buddhists, the Christians, anyone can actually exist comfortably. And we do experience many students coming from China, India, and Japan, for example. And we do experience students going to Europe, like Czech Republic, Germany. I think in general, the strategy for us to attract talents is not to try to, I like the comment by Andrew that I don't see where he's sitting over there, that actually when you invite a talent, you have to provide the proper environment for the talent to actually function to achieve the goals. But I think when the talent is already prominent, when you have the prominent researcher, he probably already has everything he needs. And it's very difficult to take away a person from the established life. And I think the main challenge for us is to know how to, not to run where the, as Wayne Gretzky said, the TUD is now. That the art is run where it will be when you arrive. The art is to find these researchers across East and West that will be the stars after they join our university. And that's what we do. And actually, that's, I think, the main challenge and the main art for us.
Well, that feels like the perfect moment to end on, and a wonderful testament to this region, and one of the reasons why Times Higher Education was so pleased to bring the summit here and the first ever Eurasia Summit to Kazan. So we have run out of time. I think we should give a huge round of applause to a panel for a wonderful conversation. So thank you very much.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.